This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. Primary day is just now 5 days away, so we're going to do a bit of a political pinwheel around the state to preview three important congressional primaries happening on Tuesday. But before we get to that, I want to welcome in Steve Cazella. He's the president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, and we're going to take a statewide look at Massachusetts voters. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this, too. Not necessarily about your favorite candidate, but what races have you been following this political season? Do you think the candidates are talking about the right issues? What will you be watching for on Tuesday? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So, Steve, like I said, I want to get into Massachusetts voters and specifically the unenrolled voters, the role they play. But first, I just want to ask you, what's caught your eye this political season? What in the polls has been interesting to watch, and what races maybe have you been paying attention to?
Yeah, so I'd say the most interesting things to me have been two specific things. The first is that for some of what you would assume to be the biggest, most high-profile races, challengers have had a really hard time even getting attention of the voters. So you think about the Republican primary for Senate and the Democratic primary for governor. Even pretty late polls this year, you know, still had majorities of voters saying they'd never even heard of the contestants. So for a while, you know, you could sort of think, okay, it's early, voters pay attention late. But, you know, as time has worn on, you still have, you know, candidates that are trying to vie for major statewide offices that voters just haven't even heard of. The second major trend that I've been watching, and that will sort of, I think, have a better sense of how it plays out on Tuesday, is challengers to incumbents. So you think about Congress, we're talking about a couple places where you have longtime incumbents being challenged. You think about state legislature, you've got a bunch of incumbents being challenged there. And then the one that I think people aren't really paying that much attention to, but that I think is fascinating, is district attorney races, where you've got a bunch of, you know, sort of reform-minded candidates challenging more traditional sort of incumbents and more traditional candidates.
So you mentioned kind of the name recognition problem. Part of that might be the fact that unenrolled voters have been growing pretty quickly here in Massachusetts over the last few years, the last few election cycles. They're always a big X factor. Are we expecting the same this year, that unenrolled voters could tip the scales in a lot of different races?
Yeah, I mean, we've been seeing the number and sort of the percentage of unenrolled voters growing for quite a while now. It's been sort of a steady growth that goes back now a couple of decades. And these days, there's a pretty specific reason for that, or a pretty specific thing that's going on, and that's younger voters coming into the electorate, registering unenrolled, and older voters passing away that were registered Democrats or Republicans. So not to be too morbid about it, but that is basically what's happening. When you look at 18 to 22-year-old voters, for example, 62% of them are unenrolled.
It's a huge number.
A huge number. So, I mean, you've already got a majority of sort of the newest registered voters being unenrolled. And what's coming down the pike is automatic voter registration, which was just passed by the legislature, which basically will put, unless you opt out, it'll put you in as a registered voter and put you in as an unenrolled registered voter unless you specifically choose a party.
So if, as young people are registering, if more and more of them are registering as unenrolled voters, what's that going to mean for the parties here in the state?
Well, it appears that we're on a continuous trajectory. I mean, there's nothing to suggest that it's going to change, of smaller and smaller percentages of the electorate being made up of partisans. So we already see on the Republican side that a majority in the primary, a majority of the voters who will pull a Republican ballot will be unenrolled. They won't even be members of the party where they're voting. On the Democratic side, you see it's approaching half, you know, it's sort of 40-plus-ish right now. We're not quite to half, but again, with automatic voter registration coming in, I feel like that percent is going to continue to grow.
So I want to give a little context there, because those are both pretty significant numbers. The Democrats, registered Democrats, now make up about 33% of the electorate. That's the lowest level since 1960. And on the Republican side, registered Republicans make up just over 10% of the electorate. That's the lowest since 1948.
Yeah, and so, they're continuing to fall.
Right. Is that an indictment of party leadership? Is it? Why do you think it is that we're seeing that?
Well, there's a couple things we're saying. One is that voters are still, in many cases, acting like partisans. You know, that's sort of an important thing to say, is that, you know, when you sort of ask them a bunch of questions, or ask them who they voted for, or just ask them which party they see themselves as closer to, they will still sort of shed their independent, you know, cloak that they're wearing and reveal their partisan colors. So there is some of that going on. But, you know, the truth of the matter is in Massachusetts, there's very little benefit to registering with a party. You don't get anything other than being able to participate in caucuses and conventions, which most voters don't even know exist. And as a result, you're excluded from participating in the other party's primary, which is the one thing you may actually may want to do and that your unenrolled friends and family members can do.
So speaking of that, you're a poll guy. That must be a pretty hard variable to deal with when you're polling. You have unenrolled voters that might even lean towards one party but take the opposite party's ballot for the primary, either because they think it's a more interesting race, a more competitive, or maybe even to try to sabotage. How do you adjust for that?
Yeah, so what we like to do now when we have the opportunity and when we have a primary going on both sides is that we'll do both a Democrat and Republican primary poll at the same time, and we'll ask the swath of independents which ballot they are going to choose if they don't know, you know, which one they lean towards, might they change their mind, and that sort of thing. And then we'll sort of game out various scenarios where if a certain percentage of your solid independent Democrats, you know, suddenly change their mind and vote for Republicans, what would that do? And we sort of show up a bunch of different scenarios to reflect exactly what you're talking about.
So is that generally a pretty standard percentage, or does that kind of fluctuate depending on the races that are on the ticket?
Yeah, I mean, what you can see is that, you know, the more unenrolled voters come into one primary or the other, it makes a huge difference. You know, if the unenrolled voters, for instance, tend to prefer a more moderate candidate, then the more of them, you know, participate in your primary, it could benefit the more moderate candidate. Other times, you know, when your unenrolled voters and partisans aren't really that different, then it doesn't really matter how many come in or out. You know, it's sort of basically still the same outcome.
All right. So, Steve, stick around. I want to bring you in as the conversation moves along here, but we're going to now check in with three of the districts that are featuring congressional races. And we're going to start with the first congressional district, which is Massachusetts' westernmost district, includes the cities of Springfield, Pittsfield, Holyoke. Tahira Amatul Wadud is a Springfield attorney, and she's challenging the incumbent Congressman Richard Neal. He's been in Congress since 1989, almost 30 years, 15 terms, and he's the dean of the Massachusetts delegation. Joining us now from Springfield is Shannon Young. She's a reporter at the Springfield Republican, and she's been closely following this race. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for being here.
Definitely.
So give us a little context. How's this race been looking as we near primary day?
So this race, as it gets closer and closer to primary day, is shaping up to be a lot more exciting than I think most people were expecting it to be back in December when Tahira announced she was entering the race. She kind of came out of nowhere. She didn't have a lot of political experience background. She's pretty well known in the community as an attorney, as for her work on civil rights and women's issues. But, you know, Congressman Neal hasn't really had a real challenger in several years. So the fact that this race is even contested was kind of surprising, I think, to a lot of people. So as it moves closer and closer, you're seeing both sides kind of ramp up their campaigning. Congressman Neal obviously has a huge fundraising edge. He has a huge base of support. His network is here. But Tahira is really building on the progressive work that Bernie Sanders' campaign did out here. She's got a lot of his supporters backing her effort, in addition to, you know, other more minority groups and other groups who've just felt a little bit disenfranchised out here. So it's shaping up to be an exciting race. I don't know how close it will be, but it's actually giving people something to talk about out here.
So this race features a theme that's been popping up across the state this election cycle, kind of the incumbent with experience versus a newcomer pushing progressive values. Have there been any specific issues that have really come to the forefront in this race?
A lot of the issues that have been talked about are things that aren't really out of the norm for these type of races. Their stances on issues like health care. Tahira has been really out in front saying she supports universal style Medicare for all health care. Neal has been really slow to embrace that type of policy for years and years. He's been saying, you know, let's have California do it or another state and then kind of see how that goes before we decide to expand that nationwide. He's also faced some pushback from rural parts of the district who feel he's not there enough. She's really trying to speak to those voters, especially in really progressive communities who want him to take a less moderate approach on issues like health care and things like that.
Shannon, what's your sense been in terms of how those messages are resonating with voters?
I think it really depends where you are. I think in the Berkshires and in the Hilltowns, people really do want somebody who's a little bit more progressive. It's, you know, not uncommon to find a lot of Sanders supporters up there and people who, you know, want maybe someone like Jim McGovern or Elizabeth Warren to sort of be speaking their values. I think in other parts of the district, they are more moderate. It's just the district is so large, it's really hard to encapsulate, you know, one sort of general overall feeling.
Yeah, Steve, I want to throw to you, as we're hearing how some of these issues are being presented to voters in the first, how does that match up with the district's makeup?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I think what I'd say is that it does match a lot of what we're seeing in some of the other districts around the state. You know, and the candidates are the challengers are sort of counting on the same thing, which is that you have more voters who don't typically show up for primaries show up. So the ones who tend to be supporting these challengers tend to be younger. They tend to be a, you know, more diverse set of voters. And if you see these sort of bursts of turnout in areas with, you know, a lot of young people, the more diverse areas in each one of the districts featuring a challengers, it would help all of them, you know. And there's statewide candidates like Josh Jacob counting on the same thing. So that'll be a key thing to watch on Election Day.
Shannon, does that kind of match up with how Amitul Wadud has approached the campaign? Is it a get out the vote effort, trying to reach people who might not necessarily normally participate?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I mean, she lives in downtown Springfield. She's been really making sure she's going out knocking on doors, especially in these areas that have had historically low voter turnout, not just in primaries, but general and presidential elections. So, you know, she's trying to do that work in the urban communities, but also in the more rural communities. Her campaign has been really, really active in making sure that they're out there door knocking. Sometimes it's so hard to even get a hold of them because you don't even know where exactly they're going to be. It's a pretty, you know, shoestring operation, but it seems like they're trying to make every minute count.
So we're talking with Shannon Young. She's a reporter at the Springfield Republican following the first congressional district race. Shannon, I know you are fresh out of the second and final debate that taped earlier today, set to air tonight. Yep. You can't get into too much of the specifics, but can you give us a sense of how that went?
Yeah, I think generally it kind of echoed a lot of the themes that we've been hearing so far. Congressman Neal is really painting himself as somebody who can bring home the bacon for the district. He's, you know, if the Democrats take over the House, he's the next in line to be the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is one of the most powerful committees in Congress. And he's saying, look, I've got this potential chairmanship lined up. I have a record of bringing money home for the district. This is, you know, it's a no-brainer to you know, vote for me. Whereas Tahira is saying, you know, we've had the same congressman for 30 years. Let's give someone else a chance. Let's make sure that every single community in the first district is being represented. And let's make sure that we're speaking to what people actually want and not, you know, sort of a middle of the road approach. So a lot of that was sort of the theme of today's debate, a little bit more interesting than their first debate. They were able to kind of go back and forth a little bit with some rebuttals. So I think it was definitely an interesting but sort of encapsulating debate.
So a final question for you, Shannon. It struck us as we were kind of talking about this race that the dynamics of this campaign are pretty similar to the race going on in the 7th District between Congressman Capuano and a challenger mm-hmm. City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. There you have again a newcomer to the political stage challenging a longtime congressional incumbent. You have a woman, a minority, challenging an older white male. The 7th district race has gotten a lot of national attention, not so much in the first. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just it's really hard to compare this district to other districts. And I think the fact that Congressman Neal has been such a staple out here that, you know, a lot of people just sort of assume that he's going to, you know, win by a large margin. You know, Ayanna Pressley has a more name recognition, I think. She was a city councilor, has been really vocal on different issues. Tahira is well known in the Springfield area. I think she's still trying to get her name out there in other parts of the district, in Worcester County and Berkshire County. And I think it's, you know, it's such a geographically diverse district. But when it comes to minorities and young voters, it's not necessarily as diverse as probably the 7th district there.
Well, that's Shannon Young from Springfield. She's a reporter at the Springfield Republican. Shannon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And just a reminder, listeners, we're happy to hear from you on this as well. Not necessarily about your favorite candidate, but have you been following any particular statewide races this political season? Do you think candidates are talking about the right issues? What will you be watching for on Tuesday? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So I want to move now to the 3rd Congressional District. So this includes cities of Lowell, Lawrence, Haverhill. It's the only race in the state with an open congressional seat. Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas will be retiring this year. There are 10 Democratic candidates running to replace her. That's right, Steve, 10 candidates, making for an incredibly crowded field.
That's actually – we looked back in history and found that it's the most crowded field except for one other race going all the way back to 1970. So this is pretty unusual even by Massachusetts standards.
So – and what's often being forgotten in the coverage of this is that the winner will still have to face Republican Rick Green in the general election in November. Joining us now from Lowell is Chris Lisinski. He's a reporter at the Lowell Sun. Chris, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Thanks for being here. So obviously, as we just said, crowded, complicated race. How has it been shaping up to this point?
Yeah, it's been an interesting one down here on the ground for sure. I think that the key dynamic you're still seeing here is candidates really trying to get their names out there and simply get the most familiarity with voters and among voters. You know, 8 of these 10 candidates have never run for an office of this caliber or, frankly, really for any office besides a town-level position before, the two exceptions to that obviously being State Senator Barbara Letalian and State Representative Juana Matias. So it's a lot of first-time candidates, a lot of people who didn't start this race with very high name recognition, and they're really just out on the ground every day trying to get engaged with as many voters as possible simply so they could get enough name recognition to try and clinch a nomination on Tuesday.
So UMass Lowell released a poll last week in this race. What did we see there?
Yeah, so that kind of highlighted the there's still 30% about undecided in this race, but we do have a clearer sense of what the top tier of this field looks like. Dan Coe, the former chief of staff to Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, topped that poll with about 19% support. Right behind him, tied for second place, were Letalian and Rufus Gifford, who was a former U.S. ambassador to Denmark and an aide to Barack Obama. Right behind those two was Lori Trahan in fourth place with 8%. Lori Trahan, of course, was chief of staff to Marty Meehan back when he represented this area, and everyone after that was down in the lower single digits. So, there's clearly a top tier emerging here, probably 4 candidates who are in the best position going into Tuesday, but no one seems to have a really definitive secured lead at this point, and with, again, almost 30% in that poll still undecided, there's quite a lot that could happen and a lot of votes up for grabs that could really swing this one way or another.
Yeah, so Steve Cazella, president of Mass Inc. Polling Group, I want to throw that to you. The leader of the pack with 19%. What does that tell you?
Yeah, I mean, it tells me that anybody sort of within this top tier, even near the top tier, still has a shot. You know, you've got more undecided than are supporting any individual candidate. So, you've got the 3 that were atop the poll. You've got sort of 5 that have broken away a bit in terms of fundraising and are at the top of this poll. So any of them, I think, really you could see. The thing that I'd look for is that they're also sort of diverse in terms of where they're expecting their support from. So if you see, for example, a burst in support in Lawrence or way more people showing up in Lowell or something like that, it could make a big difference for that candidate. So, you know, field matters. The last, you know, few days of get out the vote matter. I think there's a lot that could still happen in this race. I wouldn't, you know, sort of go to the betting table with, you know, Dan Coe's going to win by 6 points. Then you're going to have 2, you know, candidates 6 points behind him. You know, it's very much still open.
So, Chris, obviously a big part of this race is going to be the get out the vote effort. But have you seen any major issues come to the forefront? Is there any daylight between any of the leading candidates on some of these issues?
There's definitely daylight on some issues, but I think the broader answer to that is that what's most striking about this race is that it's fairly homogenous on terms of policy. You know, almost every one of these candidates is in support of a single-payer Medicare for all-style system of health care. Every candidate is in favor of repealing the tax cuts passed by Republicans and President Donald Trump last year. At debates and forums, they all seem very eager to agree with one another. I think in the most recent debate we had on Monday night, you could actually hear the audience break into laughter in the lightning round when all 10 candidates raised their hands in agreement on four questions in a row. I would say the big difference emerging right now is probably twofold. One is what I like to categorize under tone. Danco, as leader, has begun clearly calling and saying that his number one priority, if elected, would be pursuing impeachment proceedings against President Trump, whereas Rufus Gifford and Barbara Letalian are very clear that they want to stand up to President Trump, but have not gone quite that far. Some of the other candidates have made more of a point to focus on a little bit more of what you might call a positive tone. So that's probably the biggest policy difference between them. Other than that, I think it comes down a lot to experience and personal background. That's the messaging we're seeing from these candidates lately, is what kind of a person do you want representing you in Congress? Do you want someone like Letalian or Matias who has experience as a legislator, or do you want someone who is younger like Coe and is a fresh face? Or more recently, we've seen some criticism of Coe and Gifford and some others at the top for having really high fundraising numbers and the way that might turn off voters. So kind of to sum all of that up, there's a lot of policy similarities, but the big differences are on tone toward the Trump administration and personal background.
Yeah, you mentioned money there. I think that's interesting. So is Rufus Gifford leading the way money-wise? Who has been able to raise the most money, and how much influence has that had, do you think, in the race?
Yeah. Coe is actually the one who's been leading the field money-wise ever since this race started. The very first financial quarter, when it was only him and Lori Trahan who actually had official numbers to report, Coe came out with, I believe, about $800,000 raised in the first month and a half of his campaign, which all of us back then very foolishly thought would be a warning shot and keep people away from this race because they think they couldn't match that. That clearly did not happen. But altogether, he's raised about $3 million so far. Gifford is closer behind. He's raised about $2.2 million, but it's very noteworthy, I think, that $700,000 of that just came in the past 2 weeks as the candidate took out a $700,000 bank loan sort of to bolster his campaign's final days and get him over the hump.
So I'll throw this last question here out to both of you guys, and Chris, I'll start with you. There's a couple of interesting demographics at play here in the district. Lowell's the city that turns out the most voters. There's still a lot of traditional blue-collar voters there. And the district as a whole also has the highest percentage of Latino voters of any in Massachusetts. How do you think that's going to affect the final outcome here?
You know, I think it's hard to say exactly how that will affect the outcome because we simply don't know what the raw numbers will be. I think that the varied demographics here, the fact that the district is so diverse, is going to be a key factor. But I think that we don't really have any way of knowing ahead of time, you know, if enough Hispanic voters and Latino voters in Lawrence will turn out to make up, you know, differences in the whiter communities like Concord. I think that it's really going to come down to, you know, whoever can secure the greatest coalition of voters from different demographic backgrounds. I don't think that one specific group or one specific geography is really going to be the key winning strategy here in a field this large and in a district this diverse. But I do think it's a little hard to figure out what one group might, what kind of an effect one specific group might have.
Steve Cazella, MassInc Polling Group, what do you think?
Yeah, so I'd say often one thing to keep in mind with districts that are particularly diverse in terms of their population is who votes in primaries. You know, you sort of take a couple steps down in terms of the diversity from the total population to registered voters to voters who actually turn out for anything to voters who turn out for primaries. You know, the electorate just gets sort of whiter and whiter and whiter as you go sort of across those steps. The thing we don't really know this year is that in some places across the country, you have had more diverse than usual electorates. And if that happens, there was one particular number that stuck out in the Lowell poll, which is Juana Matias has 36% of Hispanics, which is far higher than her overall support number. So if you see, for instance, an unusually high number of Hispanic voters turning out, that would tend to benefit her. And that's just an example of the kind of thing we'll be looking for.
All right. Well, Chris Lisinski from the Lowell Sun, thanks so much for joining us, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Absolutely.
All right. And finally, a little closer to home for us in Boston, we turn to the 7th Congressional District race. We mentioned that earlier in the segment. Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley is putting up a pretty tough fight against incumbent Congressman Michael Capuano. Capuano has said from the beginning that he's taken his primary race very seriously. And a WBUR poll from the beginning of August found that he did, in fact, have a lead over Pressley by about 13 points. Joining us now from Dorchester is Jennifer Smith. She's news editor at the Dorchester Reporter. Jennifer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So this obviously has been one of the most closely followed races in the primary season this year. It's gotten some national attention. Tell us a little bit about what's at stake here.
So what's at stake is Massachusetts' only majority-minority congressional district here. So it's been held by Capuano. The district lines have shifted a little bit, but he's been in the seat, roughly the same seat, for 10 terms now. And he is basically making the case that he has been what the district has wanted and what the district has needed for that entire time. And he's facing a challenge from, of course, City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, who's been in the office since 2009 as the first woman of color ever elected to the Boston City Council, and now she's looking to be the first person of color to hold the Massachusetts 7th congressional seat. So it really does seem to be a race right now between whether or not a strong, consistent progressive advocacy is enough to hold the seat indefinitely, or whether or not there's a value to a new diverse lens and the kind of policy that they would push in Congress.
So interesting as the campaigning goes along here that Congressman Capuano has directed a lot of his attacks actually at President Trump more than Ayanna Pressley. Why do you think that's been his approach so far?
I think a big part of it is because they actually don't differ that much on issues, him and Pressley, as plenty of people have pointed out. And she's also fairly popular in Boston, which makes up a good chunk of the Massachusetts 7th District. And also, of course, it can't go without saying that he represents Massachusetts and President Trump is a pretty easy target to swing at. So if he's out there on the border talking about the absolutely appalling treatment of separating children from their families, from immigrant families, and then on the home front saying, you know, at the same time, I've been doing my due diligence. I've been bringing in transit funding. I've been out there advocating. My office has been a resource. You can kind of hit it on two fronts. You can really point at a high national profile when you're attacking the president, and then you can also say, but I haven't forgotten my local roots. So in a way, if he's running on his record, he doesn't even really need to acknowledge his opponent at all.
So Jennifer mentioned earlier that this is a majority-minority district. Steve, I want to ask you, how do you think that plays into the approach by the two campaigns here?
Yeah, I mean, it fits the same sort of general pattern that I described before, where as you go from general population down to likely primary voters, it historically, at least, has gotten far less diverse. The thing to watch for on Tuesday is whether or not, again, a young and more diverse electorate turns out. The reason that matters in this specific election is because looking at the WBUR poll, which we did back in July, there are very significant differences in terms of who different demographic groups are supporting. So if you see a burst of sort of a much higher than expected turnout, more diverse, more young voters turn out, that's very good for Pressley. If it's your conventional, you know, always vote in primaries, you know, that electorate turns out, Michael Capuano, much better for him. The one other strategy point is Pressley, you know, only represents part of the district. Obviously, Capuano has represented the whole thing. So how she does in the communities surrounding Boston and whether she's been able to become better known there and can even eat away a little bit at his margins, that'll also tell us a lot about the final result.
So, Jennifer, Steve mentioned the WBUR poll from back in July. At that point, Congressman Capuano was 13 points ahead of Ayanna Pressley. Have you seen or heard things from voters that make you think that Pressley is closing the lead a little bit since then, or no?
We've heard that there might be some narrowing. Of course, internal polling is always a little bit tricky to work with. But one thing that's actually been on our radar, of course, in Boston, when you're looking at the likelihood of more diverse electorates showing up, is that this shares a primary date with another very competitive race, which is the Suffolk County District Attorney, where you have three candidates of color running in that for an open seat. So the question is whether or not that, in fact, might influence higher turnout from populations of color who might have already felt inclined to vote for Pressley, but the prospect of not just one but two significant races may actually push them out a little bit more. And that will be interesting, especially as Steve noted, Pressley isn't really trying to work over a high unfavorable in areas like Cambridge and Somerville. She's trying to just raise her profile in general. So I believe the August poll, looking at the data in July, said that there were about 23% of likely voters that were still undecided. And of course, Ayanna Pressley's advantage there is if she can just raise her profile among the people who are undecided, who are basically not used to coming out and voting in the Massachusetts 7th. Remember, for a lot of them, they've never really had to worry about whether or not Capuano was going to stay in his seat. So she's really trying to raise her profile outside of Boston. But I think it is telling as well that this Saturday, one of the major get-out-the-vote pushes that she's going to be doing will be in Dorchester with Attorney General Maura Healey, who has endorsed her.
I'm curious, Jennifer, a lot of the big picture analysis, a lot of the pundits have talked about this race in terms of the party implications. It's been called the battle for the soul of the Democratic mm-hmm. Party. Is that something that voters are aware of, plugged into? Are they considering that? Or is it much more of a who do I think will represent my district and my interests specifically? Mm.
So what I've been hearing from voters is that they're pretty sure the soul is safe. The question is more about what the seat looks like. So, for instance, you'll see that Ayanna Pressley, when she's talking about Capuano's record, is not saying that he hasn't served the district well. She's saying that inequities have persisted, that there's been improvement, but there's still a dramatic difference in lifestyle. For instance, the comparison she likes to go with is if you start at the top of the red line or the one bus and make your way down south across the district, you see reduced life expectancy, you see lower incomes that coincides with increases in diversity and populations who are a little bit more vulnerable and historically underinvested in. So the question really might be, what does the soul of this seat look like? Is it enough to just have someone who is accessible by all accounts, who is fairly reliable, who is a presence in these communities, but might not be able to draw from his experience in the same way that Ayanna Pressley can, for instance, having been a survivor of sexual abuse, a woman of color, came from Chicago, lives in Dorchester now, which is basically saying, is what she's pulling from more representative of the district than what he's been advocating for? I don't think anyone is worried that Capuano is suddenly going to flip and go full moderate or full Trump, but the question is whether or not he's been inclined to raise the same issues that she has on the local level.
Well, we will find out what the voters think on Tuesday. That's Jennifer Smith. She's a news editor at the Dorchester Reporter. Thanks so much for joining us, Jennifer.
Of course.
And Steve Cazella, president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group. Steve, thanks for being here. We'll check in with you again next week.
Sounds good.
All right. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.